Hello, Leah Pika here. Today's guest is best known for helping practitioners create next-level data visualizations that won't make your cat or your stakeholders scream. Stay tuned to find out what's hot on the Present Beyond Measure Show, episode 69.
Welcome to the Present Beyond Measure Show, a podcast at the intersection of analytics, data visualization, and presentation awesomeness. You'll learn the best tips, tools, and techniques for creating analytics visualizations and presentations that inspire data-driven decisions and move you forward. If you're ready to get your insights understood and acted upon, you're in the right place. And now your host, Leah Pika.
Well, hi, and welcome to the 69th episode of the Present Beyond Measure Show, the only podcast at the intersection of presentation, data visualization, storytelling, and analytics. This is the place to be if you're ready to make maximum impact and create credibility through thoughtfully presented insights and ideas. So you may know that I'm publishing a book. I'll be sharing news and updates here, as well as bits and bytes from the book. Some will actually be in the book, some might end up on the cutting room floor, but you can get a sense of what the book holds in store for you. So I just submitted my book cover design brief, so incredibly exciting. As someone who cares like a tiny bit about design, I'm like totally stoked about it. That is super cool. And the not as fun updates, I'm still heaving around in the first round of edits. That's not as fun as some of the other stuff, but I love knowing that this book is going to be the absolute best it can be. I'm so grateful for my editing team and my marketing team. Just so exciting. So if you aren't on my book waiting list already, sign up at leahpika.com/the book for exclusive news, updates, goodies, all kinds of fun stuff. Super, super exciting. Now, the summer is winding down and speaking is ramping up. I'm really excited about how packed my speaking docket is getting, and I'm getting to come back to a few new conferences on the web. So first, I'm speaking at the amazing Measure Summit virtual conference starting September 28th. It's going to feature talks on all things digital measurement with amazing speakers like my friends Simo Ahava, Michelle Kiss, and Julius Federovicius. So the tickets are my favorite price, which is free. So be sure to register at leahpika.com/measuresummit. So I am super jazzed. There is so much exciting stuff on the horizon. Can't wait to keep sharing it with you all here. And as usual, I'm excited for today's guest, I won't lie. But in particular, this guest has added yet another essential addition to your DataViz library. It is packed with deeper explorations and inquiries in how to viz effectively. Excelsior! All right, everyone. I have an awesome new guest for you today. Today's guest is the founder of Data Revelations, a data visualization consultancy who's worked with Deloitte, Tableau Software, Microsoft, Disney, Consumer Reports, The Economist, SurveyMonkey, Con Ed. Oh my gosh, so many amazing organizations where he helps them understand and visualize their data. He's the winner of numerous data visualization honors and awards and serves on the advisory board for the amazing Data Visualization Society, which you definitely need to check out if you don't haven't already. And he is the author of a new book that I love so much called The Big Picture, How to Use Data Visualization to Make Better Decisions Faster. And he's also the co-author of a blockbuster book called The Big Book of Dashboards, Visualizing Your Data Using Real-World Business Scenarios. I have had that one forever and I love it so much. So please help me welcome our latest guest, Steve Wexler. Hello.
Hello, and thank you so much for the gracious introduction and for having me here.
Oh, well, it's well-deserved, Steve. You have an amazing reputation. So I loved the big book of dashboards for a while, even though I don't specialize in dashboards in the work that I teach. There's so much to be taken from the world of dashboards and simplicity and communication and intentionality and design. And what's really cool, I just had your co-author Andy Cotgreave on the show, which was wonderful. So it's great to be making the rounds. Everyone loves a great origin story. Everyone may know kind of where you are now, but everyone loves to hear how you fell into this world and got to where you are today.
Boy, it really is a fall into this world type of thing. And a lot of us, the notion of being specializing in data visualization, had you said that to me in college, I'd go, what on earth is that? Look, I gravitate towards careers where I have to explain to friends and family what it is I do. This is probably the least difficult to explain, but my background when I studied in college and grad school was music. I have a master's degree in music. It's a hard way to make a full-time living, so I started supplementing my career in that with computers, this is a while ago when people were beating down my door for this expertise, and I became intoxicated by doing stuff with computers, founded a software company, sold off the assets of that, founded a startup, couldn't keep funding it, and then it kind of in my mid-40s, I had to find a job for the first time in my life. I ended up with some colleagues of mine from a previous life at a place called the E-Learning Guild. It's now been changed to the Learning Guild. It's an organization of tens of thousands of people worldwide who use technology to help people learn and perform better. I was hired as their director of research and emerging technology. And I think what kind of got me the gig was I said, look, you've got thousands of people you can survey. Instead of printing static reports, let's create these live interactive dashboards where people can, hey, I don't want to see what everybody thinks. What do people in my industry think? People with a similar background in my region think about these things? And they went, interactive dashboards and responsive. This is 15 years ago. And they said, well, how are we going to make this thing? And I said, oh, I've discovered this amazing new tool, and I think it will work for us. And that tool was called Spotfire. It was not the one you were expecting
you
me to say.
Me.
Yeah, I know. And this is like the Australopithecan era of data visualization tools. This is really early on. And they said, well, this is cool, but you know, before we invest in this thing, why don't you look to see what else is out there? And I started looking at what else was out there. This is pre-Power BI. I think it may be pre-Click, but I certainly looked at Spotfire. I looked at something called Visual Advisor, and then I downloaded and discovered Tableau. And I got to tell you, the thing that kind of at the time, and TIBCO Spotfire is amazing stuff, but what kind of aced it for Tableau was it had undo. It was going, oh, well, I didn't really mean to make a line chart. This should be a bar chart. Let me just hit undo a couple of times. And with Spotfire, you couldn't do that. So was at the E-Learning Guild for 2.5 years. Then I was at the Institute for Corporate Productivity. By the way, my subspecialty is in visualizing survey data. Yeah, if you really want to be popular at cocktail parties, just tell them that you're into survey data. Boy, they just make a beeline to you, I got to tell you.
Okay.
I mentioned this because I ended up at the Institute for Corporate Productivity, which had been originally called the Human Resource Institute. And the Human Resource Institute was founded by Rensis Likert, the guy who developed the Likert scale, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, do such and such. He had long deceased by the time I joined the organization, but there was something that was kind of cool about being there. In any case, I was there for 2.5 years. I was laid off. Which ended up being a very good thing for me. I decided to put out my own shingle as a data visualization person specializing in survey data. First couple of years were really rough, and then kind of hit my stride with stuff. And within the practice, it became clear to me there seems to be a need for the first book, the book that I did with Andy Cotgreave, who has a big advantage over me. He has the really erudite, cool British accent.
I know. Everything sounds so much smarter.
I know. And he really, he's a total, by the way, he has this thick Brooklyn accent. He's a total charlatan.
Oh.
No, he doesn't. He really is from the Oxford area, you know, outside of London. But it really is charming, isn't it?
Oh,
you know?
Absolutely. Yep.
I need to develop the fake French accent.
There you go. I'm working on my fake Italian accent, actually.
There we go. but there was this need for, it came from clients who were, hey, we want to show the data this way. If we use a tool like Tableau or Power BI or Qlik, these things that are taking people, you know, three people working a month, every month to produce these things, could we do this faster? And I said, well, yeah, of course you could do it faster, but you know, there's way better ways to show this stuff. There is. And I said, yeah, hold on. I want to show you an alternative. Instead of this, you know, sea of red, yellow, and green that's all trellised, it's hard to see, well, how much greener is that green than this green? And, you know, and let me show you another way to do this. And I kind of wrote a white paper about it and saying, well, here's the way you're doing it. Here are some alternative ways. Look how much faster you can glean insights from this. Client loved it. Their client didn't. Their client insisted that they just do the red, yellow, green nonsense. And I say that to workshop attendees and colleagues and say, look, you're going to fail a lot of the time with this when you try to get people to adopt stuff. You know, even though you have something which answers the questions better, you will succeed enough times with this. But that became the catalyst for the book. I said, hey, here's the scenario, this situation. And if you have data like this, what are some effective ways to present it? And I thought, this could be a great idea for a book. And originally petitioned a wonderful colleague, Kelly Martin, who unfortunately died a few years ago, I think, to work on the book, Jeff Schaefer. And Jeff had the idea of, hey, instead of us doing all the dashboards, why don't we get third parties to submit their examples? I said, boy, that's a piece of genius. And then we had Andy join us, and it was wonderful having colleagues and collaborators. And I really think collaboration is key to creating really good stuff. And now you'd have to say, well, then you're just a flagrant hypocrite, because why are there no collaborators on the new book?
Yeah. Yeah, Steve. What's up with that?
I just couldn't stand working with Jeff and Anne. No, they're wonderful. I'd work together again with a heartbeat, even with that fake British accent. This is just kind of more my take on this thing. I absolutely think collaborating, especially with your stakeholders, and I'm wondering if you feel that way when you're creating stuff, as opposed to, well, here it is, it's brilliant, right? To what degree do you get your audience involved early on with getting them to look at possible approaches? And is this working for you? Is it as clear as I think it is? Do you run into that at all with the stuff that you're doing?
Oh, absolutely. What's interesting is that I haven't collaborated so much in my business and like teaching with people, although I've had some experience with that. I'm an only child, so I don't share well, Steve. Not the best. However, part of that journey for me has been learning how to have the humility to recognize that, you know, I just submitted my manuscript for my first book. And while I didn't co-write it with anyone, I am absolutely transparent that so many of the principles that I have synthesized together in my specific approach have come from the brilliance of other people. I, you know, I'm the first to admit, like, I haven't invented 80% of my book just out of, like, these are not fresh ideas. And this is often what happens with teaching when you're consolidating and distilling the practices, but you're doing it from the way that has worked for you. And so much of that has been a collaboration with my students. Something I say in my book over and over is how much of my content is inspired by the questions and the challenges that my students and clients are experiencing. That is literally the fuel for that creative fire, right?
The questions that they have, or seeing it, getting a sense of what they're seeing. One of the problems that we have, you know, I'll mention to workshop attendees that I'm a professional chart looker adder. There are two problems with that. One is, if someone shows me a really complicated dashboard that I can't parse, I'll say, look, I'm a professional chart looker adder, and if I'm having trouble with this, I fear maybe your audience will. Not saying they will, but they might. But the other is stuff that I have no trouble parsing. I go, oh yeah, I know how to read this. Maybe others can't. I've been schooled by this by clients and workshop attendees, and I talk about that. There's a chapter in the book about the importance of collaboration and recognizing, oh, this thing that I thought was so clear, it isn't, but if I make this little change, it'll make sense to people. Look, one of the fears I have is, you know, how do you visualize changes over time? And you go, well, probably the default is make a line chart, you know, where dinosaurs are on the left and Star Trek is over to the right and we're somewhere in the middle.
It's a big chart.
Yeah, that would be, well, it depends on how much you're compressing the axes right there. Yeah. But I'm now okay seeing, you know, for years you could flip this thing 90 degrees. I'd flip out. I can't read it. And try it. Take a line chart, turn it 90 degrees, and this thing, which is so clear, I can read it now. And that bothers me. Because I'm thinking, well, it's easy for me. It must be easy for everybody else. And it isn't. By the way, the argument that I make, and Andy Cockreave was the first to show this, is, you know, it's because people are now scrolling on phones and they're getting used to this kind of vertical orientation. And so if you have something that can't fit on one screen of a phone, how are you going to do it? So that's why we're going to start to see time visualized maybe a little differently than you're used to.
That's a really good point, because that's one of the tenets I teach, is whenever you have a time series, elapse it from left to right. But to your point, I think some of the scrolly telling, I think that's what I heard it being called, the scrolly telling paradigm that you're seeing on the New York Times visualizations, some of these like magnificent storytelling projects that they release. However, they are annotating as they go down. They're not kind of putting one visualization, because I actually caught the vertical line chart in your book as I was reviewing it yesterday. And I was like, what the heck? Like, my initial response was, what is that? And eventually I got it, but I am definitely not attuned to reading time in that direction, right?
And either am I. And I kind of go, and I even say in the book, look, freaks you out, doesn't it? Yeah, it's like I'm this thing that was so easy to read is now I'm please put it back the way it was.
Yeah. Abort.
Yeah, right. Undo.
Right, undo. Magic word. Yeah, and to your point, there's opportunity for those who teach visualization as well to recognize how the paradigms are shifting. Thanks to the media that we are viewing, the environments that we are viewing data through, they are retraining us in a way, right? From the clamshell phone to the smartphone, like, we've been retrained, right?
Well, you're bringing up the brilliance of the, you know, some of these scrolly telling things. The Times has been magnificent. Washington Post has had some amazing stuff. And the annotation layer that goes along with these things to kind of guide you as to, well, here's what you're seeing right now. Let me explain this, because it may not be obvious. I'm curious, Leah, to what degree did you, as you were writing this, and congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
I know it's a huge, has the manuscript been submitted, or is it like going to production now?
No, this is my first editing submit that I'm waiting for.
We'll talk, but bravo.
It's called the Hurt Your Feelings edit, so I'm not rushing to get it back.
I bet you it's better than you think. Did you get feedback from colleagues along the way and saying, hey, can you look at this thing? What do you think of it? Does it work for you?
Yeah. So interestingly, with the program that I work with, we were encouraged to not get too much colleague feedback along the way just yet. We worked with some of the editors to preview some stuff, but really it was focused on delivering the best possible book we are going to deliver. And then once my edits come back and it's really sort of polished, then I'm going to open it up to beta reader feedback from folks in the industry to make sure that it's like solving for the problems that they're really looking for.
There's a term, and I'm probably mangling it, but Seth Godin says, you know, seek out the boos. You know, not people go, wow, this is absolutely amazing. But there were certain chapters that I wanted to have certain colleagues look at because I thought they would be particularly critical of these things. certainly, you know, I asked Jeff to review stuff, Andy Cockreave. I have a chapter on why knowing your audience is so important. I have big problems with the infamous Menard.
I saw that. That was, you know,
it's an incredible piece of work, but it was for a 19th century audience, and you know, it's kind of this one-off type of thing, but it's considered now, thanks to Edward Tufte, the Mona Lisa of all data visualizations. And people see this and go, well, I guess I should be making something like that in my organization. I want to go all Lewis Black on them and go, no, you shouldn't be making anything like that in your organization. This was a 19th century audience, you know, very sophisticated, and they had a ruler in hand when they were reading this thing. When was the last time you saw a CEO with a ruler in hand to look at a chart? Oh, look at this Nightingale wedge diagram. Where's right. my protractor when I need it? That's mm-hmm. not going to happen. But I wanted Jason Forrest, RJ Andrews, to, you know, you may not like what I'm doing here. So, and RJ had some really good feedback and suggestions on it and said, you know, that Menard chart, it's always shown by itself, but it's actually done as a pairing with another failed military campaign. And the whole thing was really a protest against the futility of these massive military campaigns, and showing it without the other one, you may be doing a disservice. So I got really good feedback from him on that.
Fascinating. So you were able to get the fuller context of the purpose of that visualization, which might be lost if we're not the 19th century audience who's living through the time that this person created it.
And again, you know, it's just being held up as this icon because,
the pinnacle.
You know, this, you know, one particular pundit has cited it as that. And look, if your audience would respond incredibly well to that, then go ahead. But my guess is they're not going to. And the reason so many of these things fail is that whomever's making this stuff does not really understand the needs, requirements, and sophistication of the people who are going to be consuming it. Incidentally, there's a wonderful book by Sandra Rengren called The Menard System, where she has published all the different... He was a civil engineer. He wasn't a data visualization person, but this was kind of a passion and hobby for him, and it helped him better understand the data so that he could be a better civil engineer. I don't know, maybe there are 40 charts in there. Some of them are really well suited to modern business. You go, I could do something like that right now. But this infinite, I don't want to bore people with, what the heck is he talking about? Charles Menard, Napoleon campaign. It's a one-off data visualization. It is brilliant. The amount of information that's being packed into a tiny little space. And you should probably not be making anything like that in a modern context.
Well, I can tell you, I might be the only book about data visualization that does not address that visualization. And that was actually intentional because while I've found references to it and different authors' takes on it useful, there's a part of me that's curious, and I don't know what I don't know, but there's a part of me that's curious if just the inclusion of that or reference of it is sort of like a hallmark that, hey, I've done my homework, I'm a data viz person, and this is like the bat signal that we've studied Tufte and things like that. So,
well, I'm trying to undo the damage
right.
that's been done by Tufte in that chart by saying, right. look, you're going to see this. It's held up as this iconic thing. Mm-hmm. And I want to go, you know, tell people, yep, good to know it. You know, it's like, hey, your art appreciation class, your data visualization appreciation class, and recognize this probably has no business in a modern context. I thought about this, but was just so kind of angered by how much damage that I thought was being done, because attendees then go, wow, this really famous person said this. These two things are great. And right. and the inability to connect the dots between what they just saw and what they're then going home to business to do, going back to work, that was my addressing it versus it was kind of my own visceral, I need to take this on.
I completely recognized your intention behind that, especially when, and this is actually a really good segue into kind of the next series of questions I have, which was your pie charts, your very simple pie charts that you had afterwards that was actually showing a much more impactful story, which was how many people died in those campaigns.
you know, that was a tongue-in-cheek rendering from Jorge Camoes, who's this brilliant data visualization practitioner out of Lisbon. And there is something to be the immediate takeaway from this thing. And so many people have come up with different approaches to the Menard stuff, but there is something very compelling about this single pie chart with this tiny sliver showing the percentage that survived, and it can be pretty powerful. And he was doing it as a tongue-in-cheek type of thing. Seth Godin, who's a really wonderful marketing guru, and I can recommend his most recent book, The Practice. He says the Menard chart is one of the worst charts ever created. And Stephen Koslin, who is the head of the psychology department at Harvard, said, you know, he says, I really don't like this thing. It violates everything, you know, the way people process data. So there are some second opinions out there about what works and what doesn't. But the closer you are to your audience, and if you can actually turn them into active participants in the creation of your work, you may get better work, or you may get a better adoption of it.
For sure. No, this is a really interesting conversation. And now that we've touched on the pie, I think it's a perfect segue for one of the elements I love about your book so much. So you were talking about, you know, being a chart looker adder.
Professional chart looker adder, not one of those, you know, Monday morning, you know, amateur chart looker adders.
Understood. So
thank you.
I have an apprenticing chart looker adder in my household. He's my 8-year-old son, and he is so in love with DataViz. You know, he loved paging through your book. And what's amazing is that sometimes he really gets it right away, but there, whenever the scaredy cat, so it's this little symbol, this guy, that you have as sort of a signal throughout the book, whenever he sees that, those are the ones he has trouble with. So,
and that's the whole point of it, is it says this is right. Probably not the scaredy cat icon. It was originally just a cat icon in the Big Book of Dashboards. Then we called it a screaming cat. And then there were colleagues who said, you know, no one sets out to make a bad visualization, and calling it a screaming cat, you're like saying you're bad. And so I changed it to a scaredy cat icon. The icon either means, one, this may not be as useful as something else. There's something in it which is going to be hard to interpret, or it could also be downright misleading. And we talk about charts that are intentionally misleading and take advantage of the way people, you know, think of some of the bar charts where the value axis doesn't start at zero, and where it looks like this bar is 8 times as big. Well, it's actually only a little bit bigger, but, you know, you just chose to, you know, where you tried to start it. So it's the it's either intentionally misleading, or, oh, gee, I didn't know that I was violating a principle. Look, this gets to why do we see so, you know, I have a presentation called Why the F Do We See So Many Bar Charts?
Okay? That's funny.
And it's because humans, without any training or coaching, are just really good at being able to compare how much bigger is this bar than this bar from a common baseline when you start at zero. Oh, I can see that's a little more than twice as big. Oh, I can see that's, you know, looks to be, I don't know, about a quarter. By the way, that's where pie charts get a really bad rap, because they're mostly used incorrectly. You know, gee, I want to compare all these different slices. Well, you're not going to be able to compare the slices. That's what bars are for. But if you've got just 2 segments of a pie and you want to know what's the part to the whole relationship, is this more than a quarter or less than a quarter? Is it a little more than a half, less than a half? Those become instant reads. So a very simple 2 or 3 slice pie chart, they have their place, and I make my case for it. And there are these measuring cups that are based on that thesis that are absolutely brilliant. These measuring cups from Welcome Industry. You don't have to look and see, honey, I don't have my reading glasses on. Is that a half? Is that a third? What is this? I can see it's the shape of the wedge. I see that's a quarter. I see it's a third. I see it's a half. Done. It's an instant read.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, to your point, like that pie of combined with the Menard visual actually had a very potent message, because one of those segments had this sheer magnitude difference in size. And that's the purpose. So pie on purpose is actually can be a very powerful tool. And to your point, what's interesting is some charts, I don't think of charts being intentionally misleading, but the treatment of them is what leads to that misinterpretation or misleading. Just like what you said with bars done well are incredibly effective. But if they're treated a certain way, they can really mislead, right?
Look, there's an entire book devoted to the subject by one of our colleagues, Alberto Cairo, How Charts Lie, and where people are purposely manipulating these things to make something either look much better than it really is or much worse than it really is. And I think we have a responsibility to call that stuff out.
I 100% agree.
So you know that moment when your executives, your clients, peers, the annoying dude from accounting are all questioning the hours of work you put into slaving over your analytics reports, dashboards, and presentations? Well, after spending 12 years as a data analyst and marketer, I know that sinking feeling all too well. It felt like a tower of terror because it was almost like my job and credibility were in question. Well, I hate to tell you, but if your data isn't clean and accurate, they actually could be. Luckily, my friends at ObservePoint offer the perfect credibility proofing solution. ObservePoint gives data professionals confidence in their data and insights by automatically auditing your data collection for errors across your whole website, testing your most important pages and user paths for functionality and accurate data collection, and tracking your data quality and quality assurance progress over time. So, don't let dirty data ruin your analytics street cred. Request your complimentary demonstration at www.observepoint.com/LeahPika to learn more about ObservePoint's full data governance capabilities.
Now that we talked about how effective bar charts are, because I'm in the same camp, I think that if you structure the story in a certain way, if you're presenting live, that they can actually be incredibly effective. That being said, I love that your book pitched a few alternatives to bar charts that can actually enhance the understanding of information. So like cluster bars in particular. I have to admit, I have never heard of a comet chart. My son was so excited about this because Comet is the name of our cat. But it was not a scaredy cat chart, which was good. So I would love for you to let us in on what a comet chart is if folks haven't heard of it.
I know people will be watching, but people will also be listening.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And so let's say we've got a bunch of different categories. We want to show sales data from 2020 to 2021. Furniture sales, equipment sales, car sales, etc. And how are we going to show 2020 and 2021? Oh, well, I guess I'll put one bar that shows 2020 and another bar 2021. Oh, wow, look, sales are much bigger. And what you have are what are packed or clustered bars across these different categories, furniture, equipment, cars, etc. Another way to do this is create two dots just within that one category. And a really tiny dot is where you started the previous year. The bigger dot is where you ended up, and you connect them so it looks like a comet, so that the tail of the comet is where you started, the head of the comet is where you ended up. What I like about this is, by the way, I think naming rights go to Andy Cotgreave for this. I think I talk about that in the book and trying to figure out who first coined this phrase. He did not first coin the phrase lollipop chart, but one is it plays into what people do well. Positioning from a common baseline. The same reason people are good at bars without having to learn them or think about them much plays into. The other thing is they look cool. Oh my God, you've got something which is, it takes way less screen real estate or print real estate. So it looks cool and it's analytically rock solid. And oh, you've kind of hit the upper right corner of the scatter plot. You want to make stuff that looks cool. Well, first and foremost, you want something that's, you want the aha before the ooh-ah. Please start with making sure that your stuff is presenting the information clearly. If you can then make it look cool, well, that's great. And for me, the comet chart is, this is a pretty effective way to show this, and it's aesthetically appealing to most of the people I've shown it to.
100%. The three things that I try to balance in trying to balance a viewer's need for intuitive, accurate comprehension that's not taking too long. It's that blend of form where there's appeal to it. That is an aspect of data visualization. It does, when something is visually appealing, it just seems to be received more effectively. And there's that fresh element that they haven't seen this everywhere before, but that function isn't being sacrificed for the sake of the freshness or the form. It's like, as you said, very analytically sound. And that's one reason why I love another one of your favorites, which is the slope graph, which is very intuitive once you gauge what the playing field looks like, can be so effective, especially for calling out an outlier in a before after trend, right? What about, gosh, there were so many interesting charts in here. What about a tornado chart? That's not one that you hear about every day.
It's just which bars are facing in one direction, showing positives, which charts are facing in another direction, showing negatives. And they're sorted from the most positive to the most negative. So it kind of looks like, you know, you've caught a tornado still spot. So it's just, think of average unemployment rate in the United States by state. And some states are going to be way better than average, some are going to be way worse. And you sort it, and it's just easy to make the comparisons, but you're going to have positive numbers, and it's super easy to compare the positive with each other, but the negatives are going in the other direction. So you can compare all the negatives with each other and all the positive with each other. And it's called a tornado because you can kind of imagine the agitator brush inside the vacuum cleaner kind of turning around.
It's great to give these recognizable names to these kinds of views, because I think anytime you make something new relatable to something you recognize already, you can make a connection, and then you can associate, like, oh, tornado, the one that is sorted from positive to negative, and it's this way, as opposed to something like a Sankey or a Marimekko, where there's not an inherent meaning that's associated with the form it takes on.
I think it's everybody's goal. Like, I want to create a new chart type. You know, anyone in data visualization, I want to invent the cool cat chart or something like that. And I think an effective name is better than naming it after yourself. You know, so the Sankey was an engineer by the name of Sankey. And by the way, I first misread it because I saw it as this curvy thing, and I thought it was a snaky diagram.
Snaky.
Because of, you know, oh, it looks snaky, and then it was a...
Well, now
Jeff
I'll remember
Schaefer,
that better.
Yeah, and going, you know, it's not Snakey, it's Sankey. You misspelled it and went, oops, thank you for, this is years and years ago. But the lollipop chart, which is just a bar chart with a really thin line with a little circle at the end, and kind of looks like a lollipop on it. So these different names can help. For whatever reason, people are thinking, oh, bar charts are boring. I need to do something else because my audience is going to be bored by bar charts. And they said, no, then your data is boring.
You know, right,
if you have something that's important that's going to help them, they'll read bar charts. That said, if you're getting a lot of pushback or whatever, fine, use a dot plot, use the comma chart. That's a particular use case. I started here, I ended there. Do a connected dot plot or barbell chart, but please don't do something that sacrifices clarity, time to insight. You had a wonderful way of articulating it that kind of combined the time to taking advantage of the abilities of your audience. Please don't sacrifice because you're seeking coolitude. All that'll happen is people will be enraptured for it for a while, and they're going to go, well, I didn't really learn anything, and you know, it looked cool, but so what? You may get somebody for a short time, but they're not going to come back to your work.
I completely agree. And I want to expand on what you're saying here, because I think this is a really important thing for listeners to hear right now, which is, what are the use cases for these alternative visualization types? So the lollipop is a great example where functionally, I understand it to be exactly the same as a bar. However, the use case that I found when I was researching around it is to prevent this weird visual effect where if you have a whole lot of bars, lots of members in a data set, and you've sorted it, which is best practice, but it creates like a weird sloping effect that it creates something called the moiré.
It's called a moiré pattern. What happens is because you're trying to cram all these bars into a smart space, what happens is the bar and then the spacing below it, and it's flickering. It almost looks like it's flickering to the point that it is literally nauseating. To some people, it will make people feel nauseated. And that is not the effect you want to have with one of your data visualizations. So it is a way to combat that if you have a whole bunch of bars that are in a packed space and it takes care of the moiré pattern, correct?
Right, exactly. So even there, one might not choose a lollipop just to have an alternative to a bar, to say like, I just have to do something different. You're thinking about the actual reason why some visualizations have an advantage over others, even, you know, in specific instances, right?
Then you could argue, do we really need all 50 bars here?
Oh, that's the bigger question.
which yeah. is, you know, do we just, you know, take the top 12 and combine everything else? And say all others, you know, that's another argument for it. But you make a very good point, which is, well, it isn't just aesthetically pleasing alternatives. It's the bars are going to cause some cognitive problems, nausea inducing or seizure inducing through the flickering. Is that really how you want someone to react to what you spent so much time on?
Exactly. Oh, this is such good stuff. So with the time we have left, I want to actually change gears a little bit and talk about the other thing that your fans are obsessed with, which are dashboards. So now we've moved beyond the chart space and we're moving into a collection that has to sort of synergistically work together in some way. So I would love to hear from you as a data presentation teacher. This is my realm. What for you is the biggest difference between a dashboard and a data presentation or a data story?
I've had this discussion with several colleagues, and I've spoken with Cole Nussbaumer-Naflick about this, who's, you know, let's get to what I think people use a dashboard for, and the definition that we've given it, and it's very open-ended, is a dashboard is a visual display of information used to monitor conditions and or discover insights and or learn about the data. Where I'll say something which is a little controversial is, I think it's fine for a dashboard to be boring. You know, it's just there to either monitor conditions or help you understand the data. The presentation you create based on findings from this dashboard, well, that should be riveting. That should be great. You know, I don't think a dashboard is a great place to try to tell a story. Look, in Tableau, you have story points, which you'll take the dashboard and create a narrative, or you'll put this thing into PowerPoint and create a narrative or scrolly telling or something. Hopefully, you're a good presenter and will go, ooh, I'm going to hook you. I'm going to create the tension, and then I'm going to show the great reveal in this thing. Now, the reason, so when I'm giving these presentations, you know, why the F do we see so many bar charts or, you know, or any of these things, it's a presentation. But I'm then armed with a dashboard to then answer questions that maybe my presentation didn't. So come up with the key findings. Here are the top 10 most important things I think you need to know. But then someone says, well, question, have you considered such and such? And go, gee, you know, I haven't considered such and such. What, are you going to make a deck that has every friggin' permutation in it? No, create something that's short, good narrative, and good story. And then the dashboard will allow further exploration.
I love that approach. You know, I am always relating this process to actual theater because I have a musical theater background. So same thing, music somehow fell into computers. Who knew?
My goal was to be a Broadway orchestrator, by the way. And I did orchestrate a short-lived Broadway show, but continue. So I did not know we had that in common.
Yeah, singer-dancer. So maybe one day we'll collab on that. I'm always kind of relating it to that whole process where you come to a Broadway show and what you're seeing is the defined story with the stars, and that's what you're seeing and that's what's capturing your imagination and taking you on this journey. you're not also seeing all these understudies, which are the people who are backing up the stars in case something goes wrong. And that dashboard can act as that understudy with that extra information that you need to pull out if the conversation goes that way. But what I see so often nowadays with presentations is that the dashboard is becoming the new story deck where people just put the whole thing on a screen and start talking about individual modules at random, but they don't realize that probably no one's paying attention because people's eyes are going everywhere. There's no particular place where they're being directed. So the story has lost them.
Well, that's a really great observation. There's a chapter. So, you know, just to make clear, yeah, I hope practitioners like this book, but the big picture is geared towards the consumers of charts and dashboards and get them to appreciate what it is that the creators are bringing to the table. So this is much more for the 99% of people that don't create the stuff but need to be conversant or fluent in the language of graphics. And there's a wonderful made-up word, graphicacy. But I talk about the usefulness of dashboards and interactivity. And sometimes you'll start with a dashboard and it's, what is this? You know, there's too much stuff going on. Say, don't show everything. Have them have some guided analytics, which is, here are some things, and they should be pretty easy to take in. Which of these things do you want to explore? Oh, well, I'm most interested in this. And you click that, and then it will reveal an additional facet about that. And then you can click something else and go, oh, now I see the difference between this and that. And then you can keep drilling down. So that's a form of guided analytics as opposed to, here, I'm going to just turn on the fire hose, and you're going to try to swallow all this stuff at the same time, and it's impossible.
I do definitely envision a future, like a fusion of the approaches where you have this predefined story where you have a specific objective and questions to answer. However, you're then looping people into this guided, collaborative, exploratory experience that has worked really well where I've had my slide deck, I've gotten through that, but then I've brought up a Tableau, a very specific series of Tableau charts that I've made sure are clean and make sense. But then we move into segmentation and filters and things that go deeper.
It will help you find where the great stories are, but I wouldn't necessarily tell the story in the dashboard. One of our colleagues, this is a fellow Nick DeBarat, and he's based out of Canada, and he has kind of taken over for Stephen Few. I agree with Nick more than I disagree. Both of us think most dashboards fail. I agree with him. On a highest level, I agree with him on the reason, which is you're not properly managing expectations of your audience. He thinks it's important that everybody understand what he calls the 13 different types of dashboards. This is where I disagree with him, which is, wow, he's created this whole hierarchy in his way of looking at it and said, gee, if the audience understands what these different things are. So I don't necessarily agree with that, but though I would encourage, got good presentations on this thing. He said something about his work. He says, well, dashboards are boring, but with highlights. And I just laughed at that and said, yeah, that's kind of what my stuff is, which is, you know, here's this thing, but it's kind of pointing out where, ooh, here's where you should be celebrating. Here's where you should be panicking. But I can't speak for him, but ooh, this was really helpful in helping me discover something that I think is going to be important to my audience. I'm going to curate that. And you know, this is the type of stuff that you do, the type of stuff that Cole Nussbaum and Affleck does, is how am I going to create something that is curated and make a compelling presentation that's really going to drive action and interest in what I have?
Absolutely. I love that idea of it's boring with highlights, because a dashboard is not going to say that there's a story in every metric and every category that you have at any one time. But what I love about the data presentation is sometimes when it's born from that highlight, where there's that little alert that there's something going on, and then you get to dive deeper, which is what I feel the analyst should spend the bulk of their time on, is finding what's behind those highlights. And then expanding that into the compelling story that maybe facilitates change. But there just can't be a story in every part of a dashboard. That I don't know that you'd want that as a business.
In every presentation, every workshop I do, I show a slide saying, I encourage people to disagree with me because good things happen when we discuss these things and debate this stuff. But I will put this out there. I don't think a dashboard's a great place to tell a story.
I'm with you on that, Steve.
Okay, we need to find people who disagree with us.
You know? Right. If you disagree, let us know.
We need to reach across the aisle and come to a consensus with
right.
with the dashboard storytellers.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's a good point. All right. So we're heading into kind of the final phase of the interviews, and we've arrived at a segment called The Upgrade. The Upgrade is a tool, a resource, a book, a video, something that you think is really cool that our listener would love to check out because we love the tools. So do you have anything for us?
This is going to be one of those cases where, you know, tonight I'm going to go, damn, I have such a good answer.
You can always send it after.
Thank you. But it's all right. I'm going to recommend some books and I'm going to recommend a TV show. Three books that kind of changed the way I looked at the world. One is Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, How We Justify Bad Decisions, Poor Behavior. Oh, it's by Tavris and Aronson. And when you just want to bash your head against the wall going, why is somebody doing this? Why is somebody doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on something which seems so crazy? And you know, we're seeing a lot of people manifesting crazy behavior. This helps explain it. There's a new book out from Tim Hartford. In the UK, it's under the name How to Make the World Add Up. In the US, it's called The Data Detective. And it's like 10 rules. And it covers similar things. I would say Chapter 7 is a must-read about the importance of bedrock statistics and having organizations in every country that make sure that facts are facts and numbers are, you know, no one is distorting these things. But with Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, it left you with the, okay, now I understand why people are doing these things. You haven't given me any, how do we fix this? Tim Hartford suggested some ways to fix it. And I thought Tim's book was so good, I read it twice. I'll recommend two more. Factfulness by Hans Rosling, maybe one of the greatest data storytellers ever, one of the best TED Talks from 2006, The Gapminder. But it will make you feel better about the world because he will show to the degree to which things are, in fact, way better than they were in the past, as bad as things are. And he's using facts with this. So it will challenge your worldview. The other that was really eye-opening to me, Invisible Women, Data Bias in a World Designed for Men by Carolyn Criado Perez.
Oh, I think I've heard of this one.
Yeah, All four of them are extremely well-written. You know, it's not like, oh gosh, you know, I'll be better educated, but what a slog. No, these all four know how to write well. The other is, if you're looking for just maybe the most delightful TV series I've seen in the last 2 years, and it is a clinic on being a really good business leader, Ted Lasso on Apple TV. And here, I am so confident if you get a subscription and don't like that, well, I'm not that confident. Obviously, you have too many people for me to say.
You can send Steve a nasty gram.
Send Steve a nasty note. Just go, you're wrong. It is just delightful. Well-written and nuanced, but also it is a clinic on how to be a really good leader.
Wow, fantastic. These are all so great. Thank you so much. All right, so we've arrived at our final question. So this is a wild card, so you have to think hard and fast here. And imagine this very plausible scenario. You're walking on stage to perform at the Amplify Motown Singing Competition, when you suddenly trip and fall into a vortex that pulls you back to the moment you're about to deliver your first presentation. Do you remember what you're presenting about? And what advice would you give yourself?
no clue what my first presentation was. Sorry. I love this vortex, although I would never be singing Motown. I might be playing bass. You do not, trust me, you don't want to hear me sing. You know, if my family were here, they go, oh yeah, yeah, this is true. This probably goes back to sixth grade or something like that. And I was, you know, probably just awful at this stuff. Here's just general advice. I'm pretty comfortable presenting. I like doing it, getting up in front of people. But I've discovered the more there is something to be said for really practicing. And I don't know if Cole or somebody else said it, but it takes a lot of work to be spontaneous to appear spontaneous. And think of the quintessential, you know, like the, you know, if you think of, you know, who gives these great keynote presentations, and if I were to ask you this, you'd say, oh, you know, Sir Kenneth Robinson or someone like that. But probably within top five, you'd probably say, oh, Steve Jobs. You know, all those Apple presentations, apparently he rehearsed his ass off. So I would say practice, be prepared. You may be great at this stuff. I mean, like, we spent 20 hours on this, right, Leah? You know, we've been woodshedding on this for, you know, going back to 2017 on this one, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the ticket.
right. No, and I think that's a really important point. I mean, I hammer home practice wherever I go. And, you know, there are these seeming sort of aliens that pop out. Like, I had Rand Fishkin, who founded Moz and now is at SparkToro. I had him on the show, and he's one of these folks known in the digital marketing space for just these incredibly engaging, informative, memorable keynotes at his old conference, MozCon. And when I had him on the show, he dropped that he is completely spontaneous. Sometimes he starts thinking about what he wants to say the night before, if I remember correctly. But what I, to your point, Steve, is it's not just about practicing talking through a presentation. When you really have mastered a subject matter so deeply, it becomes a language that you can literally speak from. I find that to be pretty rare. I don't know that I've achieved that level by any means. But when I've seen those folks out there, it's because the mastery they have attained in their subject matter becomes another language completely.
Well, look, to these people who can do that and just, you know, spontaneously deliver something which is just is a home run, bravo.
Hats
good for
off.
Them. I will find, I'll go too long. You know, they said, hey, you're supposed to be presenting for 45 minutes. And if I haven't done this, it's like I'm having a good time. I hope other people are having a good time. But hey, that's just, you know, me and what has worked for me. It may not work for other people.
Exactly. That's right. I think for the vast majority, practice is the way to go. And then eventually you get to speak that as a language, but 100% on board with you, Steve. So unfortunately, our time has run out, but I loved our conversation. So please let the listeners know where they can keep up with you.
The website is datarevelations.com. Of course, anytime anyone has something new out, they're going to plug the crap out of it. So the name of the new book is called The Big Picture. And there's a short URL to where you can download a free e-sampler of it. If you go to bigpick.me, that'll take you to the books page at datarevelations.com, bigpick.me. Of course, there are links to where you can get it on Amazon and Walmart and other places. But if you want to, hey, I don't know, you can download a little e-sampler. And if you like it, then you can buy it.
Perfect. Yeah, it's out now. I love it so much. It should absolutely be on the bookshelf of every data practitioner. And all of the resource, wow, so many resources mentioned today. So all of those links are going to be on the show notes page for this episode. I want to thank you so much for stopping by, Steve. It's really an honor to have you on after all these
likewise.
Years of being a fan.
It's an absolute pleasure. Congratulations on, you know, on a huge milestone in the process. And bravo, and enjoy the journey. Looking forward to reading the book when it comes out.
Oh, thank you so much. Good stuff. Once again, oh, loved jamming with Steve so much. what a contribution he's made to this space, and absolutely run to the bookstore, if they still exist, and pick up that book. To catch all of the links and to register to all the conferences, get all the resources mentioned in this episode, visit the show notes page at leahpica.com/069. I would love to hear from you of how this show affected you, whether it's sharing it on LinkedIn, whether it's a shout out on Twitter, get social with it. I would absolutely love to hear how these episodes are serving you and the burning questions that you have that you're hoping this show will answer. And please, if you like what you've heard and you're on Apple Podcasts, hit that follow button, make sure, or Spotify, hit the follow button. Just go. It will take 2 seconds. And if possible, leave a rating and review. Rating and reviews are so appreciated because they tell me that I'm on the right track for you and they help other practitioners like you get this invaluable information. And don't forget to take my assessment to find out what's stopping you from getting the glory and recognition you deserve when presenting data impactfully. Head on over to leahpica.com/assessment to take a 30-second quick quiz and get a customized report of the biggest blind spots you're working with and how to overcome them. Now, instead of a piece of presentation inspiration, I'd like to leave you with another vital piece of data. It's really funny that this is landing at the exact same time with this episode, but next Wednesday, September 8th, is National Star Trek Day. That's right. So as a not so closet Trekkie with an embarrassing obsession with Patrick Stewart and Benedict Cumberbatch, this day actually means a lot in my world. Really, really good memories watching all the Treks with my family. And for me, Star Trek represents everything in life that terrifies the bejesus out of me. A raw, undiscovered frontier, the dead of space, the total unknown. And I would imagine that life has felt a lot like an episode of Star Trek for the last few years, one where many times the uncertainty and the twists and turns made you wish that Scotty could just beam you up onto a beach with a piña colada in hand and make it all go away. And you know, what I admired the most about that show is actually very representative of the triumph that I've seen people have in these extremely trying times. It was that their ingenuity was infinite. Their intrepid spirits never failed them. And their teamwork was the true glue that bound that epic ship. So to all you Trekkies out there listening, think of those things and stay strong, live long, and, you know, that's it for today. Stay well, stay safe, and namaste.